Okay, how you guys doing? Happy Friday. Second installment of the Activity 8. Name of Activity 8 was Chemical Names and Formulas. So in the first installment, what we did was nomenclature. And that's a really important component of what this lab is about. This lab is really about nomenclature as much as it is getting to see the chemicals. And this is our first sort of wet lab that we need to describe how this chemistry is done, because this is a particular type of chemistry that we do, where it's chemistry on an open bench top. We call it small scale chemistry, with pipettes of chemicals that are placed onto a plastic reaction, flat reaction surface, sort of much like a tablet. We take and we drop those chemicals onto that surface, and then to mix them, we blow air around them, and then we just directly observe them. And we have a light table, we have a magnifying glass, we have different things that we can use in order to make the chemical reactions a little bit more vibrant to be able to see. But the benefit is that doing chemistry in this way allows us to be able to look at a large number of reactions and see trends. And that's one of the ways that we learn the most about chemistry, is by looking at not single reactions, but trends of reactions. So we're going to go over today, we're going to talk about the way that we do this type of chemistry. We're going to talk about the experiment in general. We're going to talk about double displacement reactions, precipitation reactions, which is the type of reaction that we're doing. We're going to go through and do the experiment, and then we're going to talk about what you guys need to do in terms of data to write that experiment up. So let me go ahead. We're going to start a screen share, and then we're going to talk all about these items. Here we go. Let's do that. Okay, so kicking in this screen share, we're going to start off by looking at Notability and the Chemical Names and Formulas lab. So the goal here, write chemical names and formulas of common chemical compounds, describe the colors and textures of common ionic compounds, and synthesize chemical compounds and write their names and formulas for the things that we make, for the things that we synthesize. And I'm going to skip over the introduction and look at all of the materials that we are going to use in this. And the materials are broken down for us by their individual ions. And so we have all of the cations that we will see in this lab, and all of the anions that we will see in this lab. They're all noted there for us with the name of each of those ions, so that you can easily find the names of the ions and their charges. So we don't need to go to any external documents to look up the names or the charges or formulas of any of these various ionic components. Okay. Normally we do a big lab safety lecture, and because we're doing it all virtually, let's suffice it to say that I would go over the different hazard classes. I would talk about those things which are toxic. I would talk about those things which are acids, those things which are bases. Essentially, all of these chemicals that we're using in Chem 30A are fairly dilute. They're aqueous solutions, meaning dissolved in water. And if you were to get any of them onto your skin, you simply go and wash your hands with soap and water. And that's pretty much sufficient to remove any sort of contamination from this concentration of chemicals. As we move up in the chemistry classes, we start to work with more hazardous things. There's more precautions that we need to take in general. But most of the time in 30A, the chemicals are of such a nature that we generally allow you to work without gloves. We always require safety glasses, and we recommend having a lab coat or some other protective clothing that you can remove should an accident occur, such that you don't have to wash your clothes or exchange your clothes with some other temporary clothing that we have that we keep in the stockroom should an accident occur. So safety glasses are the main things to protect the eyes, because many of these chemicals, once they get into your eyes don't heal in the same way that your skin does. So when you get a cut or an abrasion on your skin, you put a Band-Aid on it, your skin heals. If you get a cut or an abrasion on your eye or chemicals in your eye just doesn't have the same ability to heal. So safety glasses are one of our primary safety features when working with chemicals in the laboratory. Okay, here's the reaction template. What we would do is we would take and mix these chemicals in a grid style format. For instance, here we have silver nitrate. Silver nitrate is going to be the first chemical that is going to be applied in these boxes all the way down the column. And then going across the row, we would use the iron 3 chloride, the potassium iodide, the sodium hydroxide. They go across that row in that way. So in this first box, we would expect to mix AgNO3, silver nitrate, and we would add it to FeCl3, which is iron 3 chloride. And that's the mixture that we would be observing there. In a chemical reaction, we would write that as AgNO3 plus FeCl3, and that's going to go to make products. And we would look and see what those products would be as they go to make those products. We do that for each one of these. And so we have a large number of chemical reactions that we would be observing during this lab. Each of these reactions are called double displacement reactions. More about that in a minute. We'll look at this style of reaction. I want to talk a little bit more first about how we actually go through and do this. And then there's a series of questions for us to answer. We'll come back and we'll hit those at the end. All right, let's talk now about this style of chemistry that we're doing and what our expectations are and how this is done. Okay, so with a blank page, small-scale chemistry. Small-scale chemistry is done using droppers of chemicals on an open surface . The surface is plastic and unreactive. And the chemicals bead up on the surface. At the end, the chemicals are absorbed into paper towels. Usually what we use is toilet paper, because the toilet paper is more absorbent than most paper towels. We call them micro towels. Instead of calling them toilet paper in the lab, we refer to them as micro towels. So cleanup is with micro towels. And water. And we simply rinse the surface off with water after we have absorbed those materials into the microtowels, and then we wipe it down again with another set of microtowels. And all of those materials that we use to clean the surface have a specific hazardous waste container that we put them into, a solid waste container, so that nothing goes in the garbage, nothing goes down the drain. What it looks like when we do this type of chemistry, let me grab some pictures here, is, so I've been spending a little bit of time drawing. And we'll bring these back over here. The pipettes are small plastic pipettes. The pipettes contain chemicals with a small label on them, and the label tells you what chemical is in there, and the labels are color-coded. The labels are color-coded such that all of the same chemical goes into cups. The cups are set up on a cart that we call Reagent Central. I believe I had a picture of the cart in there too. I might as well just grab all of this, just take this all over with us. So let's take all this into the lab. We'll drop it in here all at once. And that Reagent Central cart looks kind of like this. We've got a plastic cart. All of the reagents are on the cart. And when you go up to the cart, what you do is you take this tray and you collect each of the chemicals into the tray. The tray is then taken back All right. My dogs right now are having a play fest. They're wrestling on the sofa right next to me. I know you guys can't see it. I'd like to actually turn the camera and show you. Hopefully they're about to calm down, but they just ate and they're feeling frisky. And so they're tearing up my apartment at the moment. Hopefully they'll calm down. All right, enough of that. That was an aside. You take the tray back to the desktop where you work on the desktop. So this is a convenient way of carrying a large number of chemicals that go back to the desktop and prevents them from rolling all around. So you don't have to fiddle with them. There's no chance of dropping them. They go in the plastic tray and they just fit right upside down into these wells. And we put the name tags. We put the name tags so that you can read them when they're sitting in the tray here, which is fairly convenient. Now I said that we work on an open surface. So here's our open surface, our reaction surface. This is our plastic reaction surface. And we actually call this the reaction template, or oftentimes we refer to it as the lab top, because that's what we do the reactions in. The other items that you would take back to your table that you also have available to you is you have a squeeze bottle of water, and there are micro towels on the table to be able to clean up with. And the micro pipettes, when we use the pipettes, let me go grab that picture of that pipette. When we use the pipettes, the way that we use them is we turn them directly upside down. So if this were the reaction surface, and we're gonna put drops down on that surface, then what we do is we take the pipette, we turn the pipette upside down, and we squeeze the pipette slightly. And the drops come out and hit the surface. And as they hit the surface, they pool up into a little bead, essentially, because the surface tension of the water is greater than the attraction between the water and the plastic surface. And so the water clings to itself and forms a little bead. Actually, that's exaggerated a little bit too much. I'm having trouble making a nice, there we go. So it makes a nice bead like this. And what we want to do is we want to be careful that the drops actually drop. What we don't want to have happen is we don't want the dropper to contact the surface. If the dropper contacts the surface, there's a possibility that what can happen is that drops can be sucked back into the pipette and contaminate the pipette. So if drops make this contact with this surface, as soon as you release, the drops can suck back up into there and they can contaminate the pipettes. And then once that pipette is contaminated, every time somebody does an experiment with it, they see the wrong thing. So what we try not to do is we try not to let the pipette touch the surface. We try to allow it to drop from a height such that the pipette never actually touches the surface. And then in order to actually see the chemical reactions, we drop two chemicals on top of each other. And then looking at the drop, what we do to mix the drop is we take a pipette that is empty and we aim the empty pipette at the side of the dropper. And then we squeeze this and we push in on the pipette and we pump the bulb and the air pushes around, and friction from the air actually causes the chemicals inside to swirl in the same direction that the air is blowing past it. And so we mix chemicals with a stream of air. So we never actually stick anything into the chemicals themselves. There's nothing that's ever contaminated. The chemicals only touch the surface, and there's nothing that we need to throw away or to do other than that. So that's how we handle the chemicals. Okay, let's see what else I need to show you. I think that's enough for just kind of how we do the reactions. Let's talk about what these reactions actually are now. So double displacement reactions. Double displacement is a type of reaction that we study in Chem 30A. Sometimes these are referred to as double displacement or sometimes double replacement. So sometimes we can sit here or we can see the word replacement. And another thing that they are called is they are called precipitation reactions. The pattern is a pattern where I have AB, ionic materials, cation and anion, plus CD, another set of cation and anion. So these are ionic materials, and they are all dissolved in water to begin with. They are not solids, they are aqueous. They are mixed together, and what they do is they swap partners. A goes with D, and C goes with B. Now, in a ionic compound, we always write the cation first. So the combination becomes AD, cation to anion, plus C, cation to B, anion. Always cation first, anion second. And the ratios of these change. And what we find is that one of them, I said ratios change, I didn't explain what that means. Let me explain that in a minute. We'll get back to that. One of these usually turns into a solid and precipitates, like rain precipitating from a cloud. It's the same word, precipitation. The other usually remains in solution, remains aqueous. So this one here, we use a little S that means solid. And this is the precipitate. To precipitate means to come out of solution. And so by mixing these together, what we do, and by having them trade partners, is one set of the traded partners becomes insoluble in water based on its physical properties, and it precipitates out, thus the precipitation reactions. And the fact that they're both trading partners is why we call it a double displacement or double replacement type of chemical reaction. The AQ represents aqueous. So S for solid, AQ for aqueous, and the solid is the precipitate, okay? All of these chemical reactions that we're going to observe today are going to produce a precipitate. Only one of the pair will precipitate, the other one will not. We are going to give you some simple rules on how to figure out what the precipitate is. But before we do that, we need to demonstrate how we actually go through and do a double displacement reaction, what we're going to be challenged to do in this lab. Let's take the first setup. I'm going to go back and look and see what it is. Let's take this one, the silver nitrate, and the iron 3-chloride, and look at that reaction and see what happens when that goes to form products. Okay, I don't want to zoom so much, so I'm going to do it over here this way. Okay. Double displacement example. We are reacting silver nitrate, which is aqueous, with iron 3-chloride. So those are my two materials, both aqueous. Let's do the names. Silver nitrate and iron, Roman numeral 3-chloride. Let's take and also highlight out each one of these materials, the silver, the nitrate, the iron, which is iron 3, and the chloride. so that they're color-coded out so that we can see what's happening. We're going to swap the partners, but when we swap the partners, I don't want to start writing yet. What I want to do is I want to swap by name before I swap by formula, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to take the silver and we're going to mix silver with chloride. So we're going to go this way, silver with chloride. In essence, silver with chloride. Sorry, I should turn off texting on my iPad, but even when I turn it off on my iPad, it doesn't seem to shut off. If I try to silence it, it just seems to come through anyway. All right. Silver with chloride and nitrate with iron. So these are going to be the way that we're going to swap partners. And I'm going to write their new names over here. So I'm going to write iron, Roman numeral 3, nitrate. And I'm going to write silver, chloride. And let's, since I started that color scheme, let's go ahead and follow that color scheme. Here's my chloride. Here's my nitrate, my iron, and my silver. Okay, now, before I bring them together, I'm going to take and I'm going to write them down below here as iron 3 and nitrate, which is an NO3 minus and it's ion. And I'm going to write silver, which is a +1, and chloride, which is a -1. I'm completely ignoring everything that's going on over here. I'm just working from the name into what these names are, okay? Because the reason that this 3 is here for the chloride is not because chloride always comes in threes, but because I need 3 chlorides to balance the charge state of the iron. For instance, the formulas over here are Ag plus, NO3 minus, and Fe 3 plus, and Cl minus, of which there are 3 chlorides to be able to get to 3 minuses to match the 3 positives. And over here, they are 1-to-1 because there is 1 negative and 1 positive. Okay, but when I go to match them on the right-hand side in the products, I'll need 3 nitrates in order to match the 3 positive from the iron. And so what I will write is I will write Fe parentheses NO3 close parens 3 times. And for the silver and the chloride, notice that they go together 1-to-1. And so I will write Ag, oh my goodness, my dogs are crazy. I will write AgCl. Okay, so what I have done is I have balanced the products for charge. I've balanced the products for charge and written the products appropriately. The chemical reaction is not balanced in that I don't have the same number of ions on the left as I have on the right, but my formulas for my products and my reactants are correct. I'm going to take and I'm going to rewrite this formula really quick to get rid of all the color and get rid of everything else that I wrote. So I've got AgNO3 plus FeCl3, both of these being aqueous. Need a little more room for my aqueous in there. And my products are AgCl plus FeNO3 3 times. And notice that I swapped which one I wrote first and second. Over here, I wrote the iron nitrate first, the iron 3 nitrate, and I wrote the silver chloride second. Down here, I wrote the silver chloride first because that was what was in my mind first as I was writing. It makes no difference. The order in which these ions appear or these ionic compounds appear within the formula is irrelevant. They can appear in any order, okay? These are referred to as my reactants. and these as my products. Now I said only one of these products will precipitate. The other product will stay aqueous. Notice that I have not put any states on my products. I had states on my reactants because the reactants are always aqueous, but one product will be a solid and one product will be aqueous. How do I tell which one will be the solid and which one will be the aqueous? Simple rules. The rules are that nitrate, NO3 minus, and sodium, Na plus, never precipitate. So the simple rule, nitrate and sodium never precipitate, which means that when I look back here, one of these products is always going to have either sodium or nitrate. The other one that does not contain sodium or nitrate will be the precipitate. So here is the nitrate ion. Wherever I see nitrate or sodium, I make that one aqueous. And the other one, by default, will be the solid. So I see that nitrate. I know that nitrate is there. That's the one that I'm going to make aqueous. The other one will be solid. Okay, so what did I do here? How did I go about and do all of this to get to the answer? First thing you do, name the reactants. Number two, swap names for products. Number three, write ions from the names and balance formula for charge. Number four, look at the products. Anything with sodium or nitrate will be aqueous. The other will be the solid. Okay, so that's where we're at. That's how we go through and do that part. Okay, now let's go back and let's look at the lab itself and see what it is we're supposed to do in the lab and talk about this experiment and actually do the experiment. So going back to the lab itself, one of the initial parts that was here was part A, make initial observations for the compound so that you know what these compounds look like before you actually start. We don't have that ability. I didn't take photographs, nor did Krista, I believe, take photographs of what the original materials look like. Most of them are what are called clear and colorless. So if we look at water as a material is described as clear and colorless. So descriptive terms, how do we describe the reactants and products? Solutions. Solutions have both a color and a clarity. So in the color is either colorless. This would be a description of for something like water, we would describe as being colorless. Or it could be white or blue or yellow, any sort of color, but anything that looks like water we describe as colorless. Clarity describes how clear it is. It's either opaque, meaning that light cannot pass through it, or it could be clear, meaning that you can see through it like a piece of glass and light is transmitted through it. Okay, so we have all of these different terms. So if I were to describe and I were to have a pipette that would have water in it, and I were to look at that water, the way that I would describe the water is that this material would be clear and colorless. To contrast that, a pipette that has copper nitrate in it, copper 2 nitrate, the copper ion, particularly copper 2, is a beautiful blue color. So this would be copper NO3 and 2 times. This material is a really pretty blue color in its solution. And yet you can see light through it. And so this one we would say is clear, because you can see through it, and blue. Okay, the way that we describe solids when they precipitate is different. We need to get the color, the clarity, and also some of the physical property of what that solid is. So solids can be all kinds of things. Solids have color, clarity, and a descriptive term, an adjective that describes how solid it is. For instance, some of the adjectives that we use to describe solids might be milky, cloudy. It might be free flowing. Might be sticky. Might be gel-like. Might be granular. There's all kinds of different adjectives, and we're going to see that anything that any sort of solid, whether it be a solid which stays in suspension that looks like milk, a solid that looks like a cloud, a solid that looks like a gel, a solid that looks like jello, solids that are hard and small and granular, like sand, sand-like. All of these are different types of solids, and yet they can still have a color and a clarity to the solution. So we hit number 1, number 2, number 3. We get all these parts to describe our solids when we actually see what they look like. There's not a whole lot of room in this lab to take data, but in some of the other labs where we look at double displacement reactions, where the goal is really to identify the double displacement reaction and the type of precipitate, these adjectives that describe it as milky, cloudy, free-flowing, sticky, gel-like, the color, the clarity, all become very important within actually identifying them. So I wanted to go through some of those terms and the ways that we look at and we describe solids. Okay. Let's go through and actually look at the data. Or actually, before we do that, let me list the compounds that we have in this lab and give you some initial descriptions and what these compounds look like. Let's see if I can do that. So the compounds that we have that we are using, these are the reactants. These are all aqueous solutions, meaning that these are all dissolved in water. We have silver nitrate. This is clear and colorless. The next one that we have is lead 2 nitrate. This one, likewise, is clear and colorless. We have iron 3 chloride. This one is clear and slightly yellow. We have potassium iodide. This one is clear and colorless. Sodium hydroxide, clear and colorless. What else do we have? Sodium carbonate. Sodium carbonate is clear and colorless. Sodium phosphate. Sodium phosphate is clear and colorless. Copper 2 sulfate. This one is clear and blue. Magnesium sulfate, clear and colorless. And finally, ferric chloride we used already, so I don't need to do that. So that's the final one. So out of these that we have one that has a slight yellow tinge to it. So that's our iron chloride that is slightly yellow. And the only other one that stands out, which is sort of a sky blue color, really pretty sky blue color, is the copper 2 sulfate. And everything else looks just like water. So it's really important that when working with chemicals like this, that anything that's on the desktop that spills, you clean it up right away, because a drop of water and a drop of one of these chemicals looks exactly identical. And there's no way to tell the difference. And once you've been exposed to it, once it touches your skin, there's no way to tell the difference there either. So it's important to make sure that you work as fastidiously as you can, clean, making sure that any spills are attended to right away and not left for somebody to lay their arm into or to get on their clothing or any of those other things. Okay, let me grab the data and bring the data into this and show you what the data is going to look like. So somewhere here, I've got this set up to bring in Okay, here's our actual experiment. The drops have been placed on the reaction surface and they have been mixed for you so that you can already see sort of the outcome of each one of these. And what we see is that when we mix together the silver nitrate and the iron 3 chloride, we get a precipitate that is a white precipitate that sort of looks pearl white. You can see the light reflecting off of it a little bit. In stirring it, it's kind of cloudy. Although this is a much better sort of cloudy one next door, where you can see swirls in the clouds. That's a good way to describe that precipitate that we're seeing there. And you can see too that we get variation in colors. Some of these are yellow and different color yellows. Some of them are blue. Some of them are brown. Some of them are reddish in color. So we get quite a bit of variation in the solids. And yet all of these, every single one of these that we're looking at, we call a solid. Not that the whole thing is solid, but there is a solid which is forming in the solution and precipitating out. If we were to evaporate the water, we would be left behind with a powder that would be the same color as these compounds, or at least we would get a solid material that would coat the surface in the same color as these materials are looking here. So these are all giving us solids, but a very different textures for each one of these solids. Our job now, after going through and looking at each one of these, is to describe them and then to answer the questions in the laboratory exercise. So what we would do is we would take the silver nitrate and the iron 3-chloride, and we would go up to the lab where they start the data analysis. Oh, notice here in the compounds and their formulas, they're asking us to go through and they're asking us to name each one of these. Let's maybe start this in exercise A real quick. Potassium iodide. This is a potassium, which is a plus, and iodide, which is a minus. We need to balance them. They go together 1:1. So the formula is Ki. Let me do another one where it's not 1:1. Sodium, Na, that's a plus. Carbonate, CO3, that's a 2-. To balance them, I need 2 of the sodiums. That's a 2+ and a 2-. And so the formula becomes Na2CO3. Now, we covered all this nomenclature in the last lecture. That's why I'm not going into great detail in the nomenclature and how to write these compounds. You should have already reviewed that one, and that should be foremost in your mind. And how am I getting to these charges so quickly? Well, I've memorized them, but beyond that, they were all right there on the page for you. So you can go back and you can review the charges and the formulas for each one of the polyatomics and the charges on the monatomics. So you can get that info right there. So that's that part that you're going to do. Note that some of them are giving you the name, you're writing the formula. Some of them are giving you the formula and they're asking you to write the name. So you'll have to go backwards in that way. Then more practice with the ionic compounds. Here, we're writing the formulas for the solutions. And for each one of these solutions, it's important that we include the aqueous component because these are our starting materials. So here, what we're doing is we're looking at iron 3-chloride. This is Fe, which is a 3+, chloride, which is a minus. And they need to go together with 3 chlorides. I know I wrote kind of big here. Let's make it smaller. We'll clean it up and do it the right way. 3 chlorides, 1, 2, and 3. My 1 iron, which is a 3+. That gives me 3 minuses and 3 positives. And the formula would be Fe, no, I don't need parentheses in this one, Cl3Aq. There's my ferric chloride. So we do that for each one of those materials. Now, complete the reaction. Complete the reaction and write up the 2 resulting products. So here is where we're doing the double displacement reaction. We're taking silver, reacting it with chloride, iron, reacting it with nitrate. There is not enough room here to do the work that I asked you to do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, this is 1. We'll go down all the way down here where we looked at the chemical reaction. So there's all our chemical reactions. This one here, mixing these 2 together, this is 1 that we're about to do. And for 1, we are going to mix silver nitrate and ferric chloride, both of these being aqueous. And I said to do it by name, so we'll follow the pattern that I just specified. Silver, nitrate, and iron, Roman numeral 3, chloride. Swap the partners. Take and write the silver with the chloride. the iron with the nitrate. Then, after doing that, take and write the formulas for the ions as they are at the beginning of this experiment. Chloride is Cl minus, not Cl3 minus. Balance the charges. Minus one, positive one. Write the formula AgCl. Do the same for the second. Fe3 plus, nitrate NO3 minus. Balance the formulas for charge. Requires three nitrates to the one iron. Write the formula. Fe parentheses NO3 subscript 3. See that this guy here has nitrate in it. That is the one that is going to be aqueous. And the other one is going to be my solid. Once I do that, now I'm going to take and complete this and take this and write this up on the next, write that up on the sheet here. So I'm going to get AgCl solid plus FeNO3 aqueous. That's the way that I'm going to do it. Maybe I'll do one more to show you. I'm looking for one that might be a little bit more complicated. Here we go. Let's do this one too. Let's do a second example as the copper sulfate with the sodium phosphate. So for that example, I think there's enough room there to do that one. Copper sulfate, copper 2 sulfate, plus sodium phosphate. So this is copper, Roman numeral 2, sulfate. And the other one is sodium phosphate. Now what I'll do is I'll swap the names such that I'm going to get copper, Roman numeral 2. If it started as a 2, it stays as a 2. It will not change charge states. That's going to mix with phosphate. And I'm getting sodium sulfate. Okay, so we're going to write these ions and balance them for charge. Copper is Cu, and the 2 says that it is the 2 plus. Phosphate is PO4 3 minus. To bring them together, it's going to require two phosphates. That's going to be six negative charges. And it will require three coppers to give me six positive charges. That is Cu3 parentheses PO4 close parens subscript 2. For the sodium sulfate, it is Na, which is a single plus, and sulfate, which is a 2 minus. To balance this formula out, I will need two sodiums to give me two positives to my two negatives for my sulfate, and my formula becomes Na2SO4. Remember that I said the simple rules were that whatever had nitrate or sodium would be aqueous. So that is my aqueous. And the other one is automatically my solid, the thing that does not have sodium or nitrate in it is the one that becomes solid. So now we're going to go and we're going to write this formula down in that spot in the sheet. So that one that we did as an example, that is going to be Cu3 parentheses PO4 2 plus Na2 SO4. This one was aqueous. This one is solid. There we go. You've got two hard examples of writing the products. Let's take and answer some of the questions and look at the questions. Write the formulas, including charges and names of all cations represented in this experiment. You may need to refer to page 2 in this lab to see the charges on some of the polyatomic ions. What they want you to do is they want you to go back to this sheet right here, and we want to write down all of the cations: silver, lead, iron, potassium, sodium. Sodium again, we only need to write it down once. Don't write it down more than once. Here's another sodium, copper, magnesium, and iron. But it's not enough to write iron. They want to know the charge state on it. So in this page, in the experiment, the question that they're doing here is they're wanting iron. Write the formulas and charge and the name. Iron, Roman numeral 3, comma, sodium, comma. We keep going. Second one, write the formulas, including the names of all of the anions. Again, we're going back to this part here, and we're looking at each of the anions. Nitrate, there's a nitrate again, so I only need to do nitrate once. Chloride, iodide, hydroxide, carbonate, phosphate, all of the anions with their charge, with their name. So in that one, we're doing things like carbonate, CO3, 2-, comma, we do chloride, comma, and we keep going for all the anions that we used in that experiment. Number 3, write a simple rule for naming ionic compounds. Which element comes first? When, how do element names change? When element names change, you're thinking about the IDE ending and using the IDE ending for the anions that are there. So that's what they're referring to there. I think given the first video that I did, you can go back and reference that to how to answer that question. Number 4, write a simple rule for writing chemical formulas of ionic compounds. The order of elements, meaning of subscripts, self-explanatory in that one. When are Roman numerals used in naming compounds? Example, Fe, or let's say it this way, iron, Roman numeral 3. Why are we including the Roman numeral? What is the Roman numeral being used for? Number 6, what is a numerical subscript following an element in a chemical formula mean? So if I have something which is Na2SO4, what do these subscripts mean? The 2 and the 4. And how is that different from something that might be Cu3PO42? How is the 4 in this case, let me back that off, how is the 3 and the 2 different from the 4? And maybe what I should do is not highlight that 4, but that 4. And how are those different? And why am I making those different? This guy, the 4, being part of the polyatomic, whereas this subscript is not part of a polyatomic, but is telling me how many of the cation and the anion I have. So there, we've given it to you in words. You can translate that into the answer in that question. When is it correct to use parentheses in a formula? This is an example that is here, Cu3PO42. And now we're referring to the parentheses that I'm adding into that. When do I want to use parentheses? When do I not want to use parentheses? So that's question 7. And I think that gets us through the experiment and just about everything that we needed to do. I seem to recall that there was something more to this, but I think that Krista may have cut it out. So I'm going to let it go at that. And let me go ahead and stop the share here. And, or maybe before I do, maybe what I'll do is go back and remind you where you can get chemical activity 8 chemical names and formulas. So let me stop here, go back to our Canvas shell. Within the 30A Canvas shell, under modules, we go to module 3. And within module 3, there is activity 8, chemical names and formulas. And there is a download button there. I know you guys probably went and tried to download it earlier yesterday, maybe even the day before. I said that it was online. I even showed you where it was online before. I hadn't published it yet. Your teacher's lame. What can I say? That's just the way it goes. So Krista had let me know that it wasn't published yet in an email that she had sent me earlier. She had modified it and then left it to me to publish it. I had read the part where she hadn't modified it, assumed it was published, and that's why you guys couldn't find it. But I fixed that. It's published now. You should be able to find it. And I think I've given you enough information to be able to go through and to do this lab fairly quickly. The write-up is not as complicated for this one. And what I would like you to do in terms of submitting it, let me go back. So you are going to complete the parts of this lab where you're writing down the formulas and in some cases the names for the compounds. You are writing down the formulas for the aqueous of the compounds that are here. And you are writing down the products for those chemical reactions. And if you need to do these products in a separate sheet of paper, in the way that I was doing them here, if you would like to keep track of those products and do them this way, sort of longhand out, I'm fine with you doing that too, although that's going to be a lot more pages to turn in. But that's acceptable if you want to do it that way. That way it's easy to see where you're making mistakes. So I recommend that rather than trying to shortcut it. And then lastly, there's the series of questions that follow that. And so you've got questions 1 through 7 that also need to be done. There is a submission component in Canvas where you would submit these. Hopefully you'll be able to collate them all into one PDF. If you can't get them into a single PDF, I'll take them any way you can get them. Just get them uploaded into Canvas and I'll take it from there. But PDFs are greatly appreciated. Okay, that's our video. That is activity 8, chemical names and formulas. And hopefully I've given you enough to get the job done. All right, so let me stop the screen share. All right, back to me. Hopefully that gives you what you need. I hope you guys have a good, safe weekend. And knock on wood, I'll be back in the Santa Cruz area, hopefully for Monday. And we'll continue on next week. All right, you guys take care. Bye-bye.